This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. My co-host Anthony Brooks is out on a reporting assignment today. And my goodness, what a week we've had, punctuated by what one man did not say, what another man hinted at saying, and what another man actually, for real, really did say. First, in Washington meningitis hearings, the New England Compounding Center co-owner Barry Cadden, he demurred.
I respectfully declined to answer on the basis of my constitutional rights and privileges, including the Fifth Amendment to the United States Constitution.
Meanwhile, back at home, Lieutenant Governor Tim Murray had a little something he did want to share.
I would like to be governor. I think it's okay to say that out loud.
And perhaps not okay to say out loud what Mitt Romney said was the reason behind his loss to President Barack Obama.
It's a proven political strategy. Give a bunch of money from the government to a group, and guess what? They'll vote for you.
So political finger-pointing by Romney, positioning for a political future by Lieutenant Governor Tim Murray and other key Bay State politicians, plus digging deeper into the national meningitis outbreak. That is what we will cover in our Week in Review. And joining us to do so is Callum Borchers, business and political reporter for the Boston Globe. Hi there, Callum.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Great to see you as always. And with us is Bruce Mole, editor of Commonwealth Magazine. Good to see you as always as well,
Good
Bruce.
Good to see you.
All right, so let's start with the two hearings that we had this week on Beacon Hill and Capitol Hill regarding the meningitis outbreak that has led to the deaths of 32 people so far. As we heard a moment ago in Washington, Barry Cadden, the co-owner of the New England Compounding Center, he invoked his Fifth Amendment right regarding self-incrimination and didn't say much at all in Washington. But in Boston, Dr. Judy Ann Bigby, Massachusetts Secretary of Health and Human Services, she was more forthcoming.
These events have uncovered unacceptable breaches on the part of individuals, gaps in regulatory processes, and above all, a need for immediate and lasting solutions. I am committed to answering the questions, how could this have happened, and how do we prevent it from ever happening again?
Bruce, so let's start with you. Your reaction to what we heard both in Washington and on Beacon Hill regarding the meningitis outbreak this week.
Well, I think it was another reminder, just like the problem with Annie Dukin at the state crime lab, of how if someone screws up, or in this case a company apparently screws up, how the whole system is thrown into turmoil. And I thought Bigby's comment that she's going to get to the bottom of it and correct this, it just shows you again, I'm sure that will happen. There'll be a lot of soul searching, but I felt like these things, someone is determined to do something or is lax in doing something. I don't think your regulatory system can necessarily prevent things like that from happening. There's just, it's sort of we're so dependent on mm-hmm. each other anymore that it's very tough to regulate this to a perfection, I guess.
Callum?
Yeah, I mean, jumping off Bruce's point, I think that there's a certain point, right, where personal responsibility comes into play. I mean, you have regulations that can do a lot of good. But as Bigby said, you know, there were also personal failings here. And, you know, you have people at this company, they had internal checklists that were not being followed. And I think that regulations are designed, right, when we assume people are working in good faith, right? There you have regulations and there's some oversight, but you still assume people are trying to do the right thing. And it doesn't appear that that was the case here. And I'm not sure that you can fix that with regulations.
Well, but there is still this outstanding issue, and we'll get to it in a moment, about what many people do see as a regulatory gap, which these compounding centers did fall into. But let's hear from someone who has really suffered the direct consequences of these failings. It's Joyce Lovelace. She's wife of Eddie Lovelace, one of the victims who has died due to meningitis. He passed away on September 17th. She testified in Washington about what it means to her that she lost her husband of almost 56 years.
I want these people to know what kind of person that has perished because of their lack of concern. My family is bitter. We are angry. We're heartbroken. We're devastated. And I'm just kind of here begging you to do something about the matter.
Not long after she testified, Margaret Hamburg, who's the commissioner of the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, told the congressional panel on the House side that she actually does know what she thinks needs to be done.
There are gaps in the oversight authorities of the state who have primary responsibility for overseeing compounding pharmacies and the FDA, and we need to make sure that we have a seamless system that protects patients.
So, Bruce, I take your point earlier that regardless of whatever groups of regulations we do have, determined individuals will do what they're determined to do. But Margaret Hamburg here is pointing to the fact that she believes that we don't have a, quote, seamless system. So do you think that there is now the political will to maybe sort of fill in the gaps or make the system more seamless?
Yeah, I think it'll happen very quickly. 32 deaths, I think Congress, this is one thing that they, almost everybody down there can agree on. Although I did see one of the senators, a Republican, sort of questioning, didn't you discipline this company, even though you say you have no regulatory authority? What was that? It was just a bluff? And I thought that was an interesting question that didn't really get answered.
Well, in fact, on the House side, House Republicans put out a report this week also that said that they believe the regulatory system exists in right now to have stopped something like the NECC outbreak from happening, but that it was just a failing on both the part of the FDA and those folks here at the state level in Massachusetts, Callum.
Yeah, I mean, there's an argument to be made for that because we know that there were red flags about this company for a while and that, you could look at the Mass Pharmacy Board, for instance, that, thought about disciplining the board and at some point decided not to, possibly because of a conflict of interest with some board members. There's that balance, right? I mean, there was enough of a regulatory framework in place that the flags went up, but they weren't enforced perhaps as strongly. But then there is that other point that how seamless were they and perhaps the regulations need to be stronger. Finding that balance, I think, is really what's going to be tricky here.
Right. And Congressman Ed Markey has filed some legislation about this. And also this week we heard that there could potentially be bipartisan support on the Senate side for similar legislation, but we'll have to see what happens. But both of you mentioned something that kind of made me think of a bigger question here. And that's something that we heard on Beacon Hill. Someone testified here in Boston that one of the reasons why the NECC even began manufacturing the steroid, the then tainted steroid that was behind this outbreak, was because it was in short supply. There were so few national manufacturers that were making it, basically down to one, that hospitals had this massive demand and they were filling that gap. So, Bruce, to your point about the interconnectedness of, honestly, the medical system, it does seem like, there are could be potentially thousands of drugs out there with a small number of manufacturers that compounding centers would love to step in and create.
Right. And it makes sense that you could have a handful of companies producing these drugs. But I noticed that Partners, the chain that owns Mass General, they're talking about doing their own compounding center and sort of taking it all in-house now, which is sort of fascinating. Again, that would seem to be driving up costs if everybody starts doing their own thing. So it's very interconnected.
Callum, your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, even if the partner's idea works, it's a long-term solution, but it doesn't do a whole lot of good in the short term. So I know one of the other things that they're thinking about is trying to push for loosening regulations so that, hospitals within the partner system, let's say if one hospital is in short supply, could give or could rather get drugs from another hospital that has a surplus, which apparently is not allowed right now. And so you do have this wrangling right now within the existing framework about what the heck are you going to do to fulfill the short drug supply as well. There's a lot of problems all going on at once.
At every level, in fact. So let's move on, if we can, to politics and the political futures for a number of Bay State politicians that were all over the news this week. First, there was a huge spike of chatter around Senator John Kerry regarding if or if not, he will become the next Secretary of State or Secretary of Defense in the Obama administration. Now, the senator hasn't uttered a peep about it all week, but we did talk to Jim Walsh, lecturer at MIT Security Studies program, and he said this.
That would mean a big change in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and it would have big implications for Massachusetts electoral politics here at home.
So, Callum, let's start with you. If indeed Senator Kerry does become a cabinet member, it would mean big changes. What do you think are the most important big changes here in Massachusetts?
Well, I guess the first one, right, is who's going to fill that seat. The obvious, the Republicans actually sort of have their house in order here. I mean, everyone assumes that it would be Scott Brown trying to get his seat back. The Democrat side is much more up in the air, so that would probably be the big thing right there. But the wild card, of course, is that, Scott Brown could choose to hold out and go for the governor's seat instead, and then that would really throw a wild card in there as well. We've also heard Deval Patrick mentioned as a possible fit for attorney general. Of course, he has said, no, I'm not going to do that. But, as you played earlier, Tim Murray wants that job someday, too. So there's just a whole lot of dominoes to fall here, aren't they?
Yeah. And in the last time that we had a Senate seat open up, sort of an interterm Senate seat, there was the special election, of course, which is what first sent Scott Brown to Washington. So just remind us, Bruce, Governor Patrick, if indeed John Kerry became a cabinet member, he would first get a chance to appoint someone to fill that seat temporarily, right?
That's right. And last time he got someone, Paul Kirk, who pledged that he wouldn't run for the office. And I think the expectation, well, there's no guarantee, but the expectation is that he would probably do the same thing again. I'm sort of the opinion, you know, as much as a reporter, I would like to see Kerry go into the cabinet because that would create all sorts of interesting stories. I think it's a really bad idea.
Why?
Well, here's a very senior senator for representing Massachusetts. He's got 2 years left on his term. I think he should serve it out. And I know he always wants to go off and do something else, but I think he should serve it out. And who really wants, I mean, as a voter, do you really want to put up with another special election, which will be followed by yet another election 2 years later? It's just nonstop mayhem.
That's interesting because, Callum, I also saw, forgive me, I can't remember actually who's called, Scott Lehigh, I believe, his column in The Globe saying that if indeed Kerry does move to the cabinet, he's giving up a chance to build a legacy as a senator.
Yeah, I mean, Scott made the good point at the end of his column, I thought, which was that we don't really remember our Secretaries of Defense all that much, right? And that's, of course, the position lately that he's been rumored for even more because Susan Rice appears to be the early frontrunner for Secretary of State. And he makes a good point. We do remember those legendary senators, of course, the last being Ted Kennedy from our own state. So I think he has a good point there. You know, John Kerry, although, as Bruce said, he does seem to always be sort of angling for that next post, he has a real opportunity here in his current job as well.
And, oh, Massachusetts. Massachusetts could become the state of the endless election, couldn't
it? That's right.
Okay, well, on that note, let's talk very briefly about Lieutenant Governor Tim Murray. Yesterday at the meeting of the Greater Boston Chamber of Commerce, he, of course, said this.
I would like to be governor. I think it's okay to say that out loud.
This was like the least surprising non-announcement ever, Bruce. Is it too early to think about the 2014 gubernatorial race?
No, it's not too early for him because I think he needs all the time he can get. And I've seen him a lot standing next to Deval Patrick, and almost any politician sort of pales next to him. He's a tough act to follow, if you will. So I thought this was interesting. The governor was at one meeting that morning, and the lieutenant governor was sort of making it like a coming out little party for himself. And I thought he needs to do more of that sort of standing apart from the governor and starts to, well, he's obviously got to rehabilitate himself quite a bit, but that's important to sort of separate himself a little bit from Deval Patrick.
Callum?
I think that the timing is very important here, right? I mean, you mentioned he's got a little bit of rehabilitating to do after that rather embarrassing car accident from earlier on in the year. And now we're hearing Scott Brown, you know, being rumored as a possible candidate for governor as well. And I mentioned the Deval Patrick rumor for attorney general, which would, of course, open the door for Tim Murray to serve in the meantime. So the timing makes perfect sense here for why he would want to throw his name into the ring. Plus, it seems as though our election cycles start earlier and earlier every time around, don't they?
Oh, yes. In fact, they do. But while we're on this point. So other potential names, you mentioned Scott Brown. I've seen Martha Coakley's name pop up. Who else do you think might be having their eye on that corner office?
It's a great question. You know, we've heard Marty Meehan's name as a possible Senate candidate. Who knows? Maybe that would be something he'd be willing to explore. Ed Markey is also, you know, in the running for that possible Senate seat. But, you know, I figured both of those jobs, I think there's going to be some crossover, in other words, between those possible suitors, I would think.
Bruce, do you have any other names
well,
in mind?
Well, Steve Grossman, the treasurer, sure. Definitely, I think, would like to run. And I think there'll be a lot of people that will want to run for that office.
Well, they have until, I don't know, tomorrow to figure it out since we aren't talking about endless elections. But let's move on sort of bore down into the city level and talk briefly about Mayor Tom Menino. He's been at the Brigham and Women's Hospital for the past 3 weeks receiving treatment for a blood clot, viral infection, and compression fractures in his back. He's been in the hospital for so long that doctors at the Brigham gave a press conference earlier this week. Here's Dr. Charles Morris.
We're using a couple different modalities, actually, both pharmacologic and otherwise, to help with his pain, and we have no reason at all to be concerned that the kinds of medications he's taking have any impact on his ability to be engaged and be present.
As to the question of who's running the city, the mayor's spokesperson, Dot Joyce, says, well, the mayor is.
He does have a city to run, so he's being briefed daily. He's getting briefing books here at night and during the morning so he can make decisions.
Bruce, has the mayor's long hospitalization had an effect on how the city of Boston is being run?
I don't notice any big change. If he's in Italy, if he's here, it seems to be operating fairly smoothly. The last time I saw him, he came out in regard to the scandal at the state drug lab, and he was a little unsteady on his feet, wearing tennis shoes with a suit, looked a little shaky, if you ask me. But he still seems to, you know, be our same mayor.
But I guess, I mean, the big thing that this hospitalization is making people wonder is, like, are we now at the cusp of a post-Menino Boston? Is it too early to even start wondering that, Callum?
No, I don't think so. I mean, regardless of his hospitalization, he is 69 years old now. So we are getting to that point now where it's maybe time to start thinking about what would be next. But I do think as far as running the city from the hospital, it's a little bit easier now at this stage. You know, what we've been told from the doctors is that the viral infection and, you know, the blood clot have been taken care of. What's really keeping him in the hospital now is back pain, which I would think would be a little bit easier for him to keep up with his duties if he was just dealing with that one thing as opposed to all the others that he originally went in for.
Except for the fact that I think that the doctors at the Brigham's press conference said that he may be in the hospital indefinitely until they figure out how to sort out that back pain.
Right. We have no deadline right now, do we?
All right. So let's move on to talk about the Republican Party and its future both nationally and here in Massachusetts. This week, we talked with Stephen Aylward. He's the vice president of the Massachusetts Republicans Assembly. They call themselves the Republican wing of the Republican Party, just before the state GOP took a vote on the national platform. And here's what he said about all those calls we've been hearing in the past week or so to make the party more moderate on social issues.
We have consistently seen moderates and liberal wing of our party put up candidates and tell us that those are the ones that can win because the voters, they appeal to the voters, and that doesn't appear to be the case. The conservatives in the House that won were, in fact, conservatives.
Well, party faithful for the Massachusetts GOP overall seemed to disagree with Aylward's, you know, point there, broader point. And on Tuesday night, the Massachusetts GOP rejected the national party's platform, strict language on abortion, essentially going for a more moderate stance. So, Bruce, a small step, but what do you see ahead for the Mass GOP?
I think your guest's opinion, it doesn't make any sense to me, because I thought Scott Brown, Richard Tessay were very attractive candidates, but they had to run, in a sense, against the National Republican Party. Elizabeth Warren just hung, you know, if Scott Brown goes, he'll push for a Republican Senate, and look what you'll get if that happens. And it was a very effective argument. That's what I think the Massachusetts GOP, I think the candidates are doing the right thing, but they're always being compared or being contrasted with the national party. And so do you send them down there to be part of that? Or you know, that's the trouble. And I think his argument about, you know, moderates don't sell in Massachusetts, moderate Republicans, you look back at some of the Republican governors that ran this state for a very long time. They were all fit that same mold, and they were very popular.
In fact, I mean, Callum, that's exactly a point that when Anthony was talking to Stephen Aylward earlier this week on the program about this, that's the point he was trying to make, that, you know, maybe it's time for Massachusetts Republicans to, you know, aim to have a greater influence on the national party as a whole.
Well, I think that's really where the push has to come, right? I mean, you heard it from Richard Tessay on that same day, talked about he really felt like he was hurt by the national profile of his party. So I think that the long-term solution for the Mass GOP is to try to have some influence on the national party so that that doesn't come back to bite them. I think that...
And in order to do so, they have to get elected.
They have to get elected, right? They have to get elected, or you have to have, you know, folks like Mitt Romney perhaps become sort of that senior statesman. Perhaps his remarks this week didn't help his case in that regard, but to have more moderate senior statesmen in the party who would say, guys, we really need to reframe here. And we've heard some of that second guessing in the last couple of weeks.
Well, let's take a moment, if we can, to talk about exactly what Mitt Romney said that might negate him, as you said, from future senior statesman status, because this week he was heard saying in at least two private conference calls with high-level donors that he lost the election because of what Romney said were gifts the Obama administration gave to African Americans, Latinos, and young voters. Here's one excerpt from that conference call.
What the president did is he gave them two things. One, he gave them a big gift on immigration with the DREAM Act amnesty program. Number two, put in place Obamacare, which basically is $10,000 a family.
And then he went on to say this.
It's a proven political strategy, which is give a bunch of money from the government to a group, and guess what? They'll vote for you. The giving away free stuff is a hard thing to compete with.
Callum, let's start with you. It also seems very hard to compete with Romney's ability to alienate his own party.
Well, you certainly got some criticism from people within his own party. I think Bobby Jindal was very critical of what he said.
Romney was absolutely wrong.
He did. And even Kelly Ayotte, who was considered a running mate possibility, wasn't a big fan as well, though she gave him some context, benefited out. But I think the biggest thing, though, is that there was no sort of responsibility taken on his part that, we made a misstep here or we didn't reach out enough to those same voting blocks that he's talking about right there. I mean, there's no question that is where he lost the election. And he could fairly criticize the president, as he did earlier, for the timing, let's say, of that temporary amnesty program for some young illegal immigrants. I mean, it was just a few months before the election. Those are all fair criticisms. But as you say, he sort of has a knack for phrasing things in a way that can, sometimes seem abrasive. And right now, what the GOP macro is trying to do is kind of reframe and think about how are we going to start winning these elections going down the line? And that means looking inward, not pointing the finger at what did the president do.
Mm. And Bruce, I mean, do you think that this does sort of signal a possible beginning of the end of Romney's future as, as a elder Republican statesman or someone who can lead his party forward?
Yeah, I think he's got a lot of problems. I think he's going to have to fade away for a while and find a role to play. And sometimes, you become more fond of people if they aren't in your face all the time. And he needs to spend, I think, several months at least sort of staying out of trouble, staying out of the public eye, and then find a way to get back in. And I think he is a very committed, very honest, very decent person. And I think he could contribute to the Republican Party. And as you saw at the end of the campaign, once he was started to act more like himself, I think he was confident. He was sort of comfortable as a candidate.
Was this not also Romney being himself in this phone call? I mean, that's what a lot of other of his detractors are saying, that this is the same Romney of the 47%.
Yeah, I think that's true. But there is a context. It's after you lost this election that he's been working for years and years and years. And then, he's trying to explain away why he lost. And, there's bound to be a little bitterness that creeps into your voice and everything. And it was funny that one of the people he's on the phone with put the LA Times reporter on the phone so they can listen in. So obviously, his party has it in for him, too.
Oh, interesting. Well, on that note, we just have a little bit of time to talk about our weekly hubbubs, and those are those stories that didn't quite make it to this table as top-of-the-line news, but Callum, let's start with you.
Yeah, not a top-of-the-line news, but I spent my Tuesday night over at an award ceremony given by the Hockomock Area YMCA. They have a terrific program for special needs children, and this year they honored Rick and Dick Hoyt with their annual Legends Award. Of course, Rick and Dick Hoyt are that fantastic, father-son duo. Rick has cerebral palsy, and his father, Dick, pushes him in the wheelchair in the Boston Marathon for the last 30 years. They've done Ironman triathlons, inspired countless people over the years, including myself. Full disclosure, I also have cerebral palsy. I can remember them coming to my middle school, when I was in, sixth, seventh grade, about 12 years ago. And this was the first time I had seen them in person since then. And it was just unbelievable. Rick is 50 now, and his father is in his 70s, and they're still going. And I tell you, they played this video showing Dick, taking Rick out of the little boat from the Ironman. There's the swimming portion, and then carrying him to the bike. And it's sappy, but I'm crying. Everybody in the room is crying. It's just, it was unbelievable. So really a great memory that there are still so many great, inspiring folks out there. It was a fun night.
Especially year after year after year.
Unbelievable.
As well. Bruce, your hubbub.
Well, Magna, I see you have the globe in front of you, so you and I may have the exact same one.
Does it have to do with birds?
Birds, yeah. So can we split it up?
We can split the hubbub. Go for it.
Which bird do you want to talk about?
I want to talk about, I'll talk about the ones that came north from down south, the brown pelicans.
Okay, you take them. I'll take the northern lapwings, who are making their way from Scandinavia down to Africa. And along comes Hurricane Sandy and blows them across the Atlantic, and they end up here in Massachusetts. And I thought it was a fascinating story because they arrived sort of bedraggled and no energy left. But they're here now, and so what happens to them? Because they can't make it back to Africa. And so it's a very interesting situation. Now, your bird, they do have a solution, so you take it from there.
Okay, well, I was going to say that the same storm brought some brown pelicans from North Carolina into New England. But actually, I mean, I was charmed by these European birds that came along. I love your description about them being bedraggled when they sort of finally landed here in New England. And having done many a transatlantic voyage on U.S. Airlines, yeah, you're a little bit bedraggled when you finally land back in Boston. But birders in New England were very, very excited. Joan Walsh, who is the director of bird monitoring at the Mass Audubon Society, said, "It's the equivalent of walking down Mass Ave and seeing 15 double-decker buses filled with Brits wearing Burberry jackets." So birders, take advantage of these foreign visitors while you can. Bruce Moll, editor of Commonwealth Magazine, always great to have you. Thanks so much.
Good to be here.
And Callum Borchers, political and business reporter for the Boston Globe. Have a great weekend, Callum.
You also.
Stick with us, because coming up next on Radio Boston, why the Petraeus Affair is especially bad for women. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.